Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much for turning up so early on a Monday morning. I think it is a suitable honor to our very special guest this morning, President Piñera of Chile. I am Martin Indyk, the Vice President and Director of the Foreign Policy Program here at the Brookings Institution. I'm happy to be joined on the podium this morning by Mauricio Cardenas, who is the Director of the Latin American Initiative at the Brookings Institution. We are, as I said, very honored today to have President Piñera address us. He's a man who is steeped in economics, educated first at the Pontifical Catholic University of Chile, and then at Harvard, where he received his MA and PhD in economics. A successful businessman, he began his political career in 1988 when democracy was restored to Chile. And 1 year later, he was elected as the senator for Santiago. His expertise was in reforming social programs, the tax system, and increasing the minimum wage, where he made a considerable impression in the Senate. He served on the Commission for Justice and Democracy and contributed to various important initiatives in the political life of Chile related to the democratization of the Republic's constitution. He was also part of the Human Rights Commission and made a reputation for himself by condemning the human rights violations of the military government. He has since then been very active in politics in Chile. He was president of the Renovación Nacional, a centrist political party that represents the Chilean middle class, holding that position until March of 2004. In the 2010 election this year, Mr. Piñera was elected president as the head of the Coalición Por el Cambio, a coalition that united the center-right and the political center in Chile, achieving for them a historic victory for the first time in 50 years, taking power. He was sworn in as president some 2 weeks after the devastating earthquake that rocked his country. You will probably recall that his inauguration was also struck by one of the aftershocks of that earthquake, a reminder, if any was needed, of the terrible devastation and hardship inflicted on the people of Chile, who now look to their president to lead them out of this crisis. He is a man for the times. He has deep political experience, the founder of the conservationist foundation, Parque Tantuaco, and he now, as president of Chile, comes to Washington representing a country to whom I think all Americans, Mr. President, are full of identification and admiration for the way that your people have handled this terrible tragedy. And we ask you to take back to them the support and good wishes of the American people for a full and effective recovery. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming President Piñera to the Brookings Institution.
Thank you very much, Martin. Good morning to all of you. I would like to say hello to many of you, starting with Mauricio, Chilean senators, José Miguel Insulza, ambassadors, I would like to make a short presentation on what was our program before the earthquake and how it will be affected after the earthquake and tsunami that we had to face on February the 27th. First of all, we had a very good period, 12 years of plenty between 86 and 97. This was a Chilean miracle. Our average growth rate was 7.8% per year for 12 years. Our productivity was increasing at 3.1% per year. Our job creation was very healthy, and the unemployment rate went down very significantly. At that same time, the world was growing at a much less path, and therefore we were among the 10 fastest growing countries in the world. In that period, we also were able to recover our democracy, which is a natural way of life of the Chilean people, in a very peaceful and smart way. Unfortunately, those years of plenty changed after the Asiatic crisis in 1998. From then until now, the average growth rate of our country is less than half of what it was. The unemployment creation is also half of what it was. The productivity, instead of grow at 3.4%, is almost stagnated. At the same time, the world was able to increase its growth rate, and therefore we, instead of being part of the 10 fastest growing countries in the world, we are among in the middle of the table. For that reason, we can make this comparison. We see clearly that in the first period of plenty, Chile was a leader in terms of growth, job creation, and many other things. After that, we are in the middle, just coupling with the average of the world. And one of the main objectives of our government program is to recover our capacity to grow and create jobs. This is the annual growth rate of the last four governments in Chile. You see that the tendency is clear, and we would like to change that tendency. And that's, as I just said, is the main objective of our government program. That's why we passed, as many newspapers have said, from the Chilean miracle to what has been called the Chilean siesta. Our goal as government, first of all, is to recover a capacity to grow at 6% per year. If we are able to do so, and I think that we are, we will be able, within this decade, to achieve a level of per capita income of 24,000, which is the threshold between underdevelopment and development. And we will also be able to defeat poverty. Therefore, the main objective of our government is to be able to achieve within this decade a country that has been able to defeat unemployment, to defeat poverty, and to defeat underdevelopment. To achieve this, we need to create jobs, 200,000 jobs per year, which was something that we did in the past, but we lost that capacity. In the presentation that I will give you are all the details in terms of our plan. Maybe in the question part of this, we can go deeper in any of these issues. The third thing is that the second objective of our government is to start defeating crime. The crime rate has been increasing significantly, and right now is the main problem, before the earthquake, of course, of the Chilean society. And we have already been able to achieve very important success in the way that we are defeating crime. There is one day which is called the Día del Joven Combatiente, which is normally a nightmare of destruction, death. This year was a very peaceful one. We took all the providence in order to achieve and guarantee security, public safety, and also to restore the possibility of living in peace for our people. The third objective is to undertake a very deep reform in the health sector. And the fourth one is to do the same in the educational sector. Those are the main objectives of our government. And on top of that, of course, to defeat and eradicate poverty within this decade. We are planning to eradicate extreme poverty within our government the next 4 years and to be able to eradicate poverty within the decade. So basically that was the platform under which my government was elected on January the 17th. But that's not all. We also need to face what the earthquake and tsunami destroyed in our country. At 3:34 a.m. on Saturday the 27th, Chile was hit by one of the worst earthquakes in the history of mankind. Actually, it was the fifth worst earthquake in the known history of mankind. And it was followed by many tsunamis. That was a very devastating experience for my country. It lasted more than 2 minutes, and it affected the heart of our country because 75% of the population lived in areas that were affected by the earthquake and tsunamis that came after. These are the five worst earthquakes in the history, in the known history, of course, of mankind. Two of them have taken place in Chile. The first one in Valdivia in 1960 and the last one on February 27. It was so big that it changed the axis of the world. It displaced the placa de Nazca 8 meters. And as I was telling you before, it is among the five worst earthquakes in the history of mankind. I will show you some pictures. This is Juan Fernandez, Robinson Crusoe Island, before the tsunami. And this is after the tsunami. This is Constitution, a port city, before and after. This is a small town called Iloka, before and after. This city was absolutely devastated. This is a route, a port before and after. I could show you so many pictures because it was a real catastrophe that affected. But the most sensible loss is the loss of lives. We lost 342 people, and we are still have 95 people which are disappeared. Probably most of them are dead. 2 million people were affected, all 800,000 victims. 370,000 homes were destroyed or severely damaged. 4,000 schools were destroyed or severely damaged, which represent 45% of the total school system of our country. 79 hospitals in the affected zones are condemned or severely damaged. And we think that the bill that we will have to pay for the rebuilding of our country will come close to $30 billion, which is 17% of our GNP. From this, we will have to subtract, of course, insurance, compensations, but at the end of the day, this is the total destruction that the earthquake and the tsunami provoked in Chile. And we will have to face this. For this, we are planning to undertake a plan that has three phases. The first one was the emergency, the immediate emergency to take care of the people that lost their life, to take care of the victims, to restore public safety, to restore basic services like water, electricity, and food. That has already been done. And it took us 30 days to restore those basic aspects after the emergency. The second is the winter emergency. We are running a race against winter because we have to come with 200,000 emergency shelters before the winter rains and cold hit our country. We have also a health emergency to be able to restore our public health sector before the diseases and the attention that people need are there. And we are running a race against not losing the educational year because we will need to place 1,200,000 students that lost the schools. For this, we have set a time framework of 6 months, and we hope that we will achieve our first goal 2 weeks from now, when we will be able to guarantee that all kids, boys and girls, will be attending schools. In terms of emergency shelter, we have a longer period, June the 21st, which is the day that the winter starts in my country. This will imply a total cost for the public sector of about $10 billion. And we are planning to fund this, first with fiscal austerity that has already begun. We are sending today a bill to the Congress that will create a reconstruction or rebuilding fund and a donation law. We will use our state savings that today amounts to something around $11 billion. Our objective is that we will also only use increases in that fund, so the absolute amount of the fund will not be touched. And we hope if the copper price stays high as it is today that we will be able to use what will be saving from now on, not what has already been saved. We will use public indebtedness. Actually, our public debt is zero or negative, and therefore we can responsibly use public indebtedness as part of our funding package. We will also announce this week some tax adjustment. And finally, we will be selling non-core public assets. These are the six sources of funding for our rebuilding plan that we will make public within this week in Chile. We will need, of course, not only financial resources, but also human resources. And that has been something very, very important, because the reaction of people in terms of collaboration, in terms of willingness to work again, has been extremely strong, and is something that is part of our rebuilding effort. It's a very important and necessary part of our rebuilding effort. We, therefore, will face two major challenges. The first one is to retrieve the wasted time and recover our growth and job creation capacity. And the second is to run faster and take a big leap towards development. This is what we have to do in order to become a developed country without poverty within this decade. But also, basically, we had a government program which was extremely ambitious to restore our growth capacity and job creation capacity, to be able to defeat crime or start defeating crime, to improve the quality of our health system and our educational system. And now we have another challenge, which is to face the emergency and the reconstruction of all that the earthquake and the tsunami destroyed in my country. But I'm very confident that we have an excellent, strong, and reliable plan, and that with the help of all Chileans, we will be able to achieve our government goals and at the same time rebuild our country. Thank you very much.
Very well, Mr. President. Thank you very much. The President has graciously accepted to take some questions from the public, and we have about 40 minutes for that before he goes to another meeting. But let me try to provoke this conversation and stimulate your questions. First by saying, Mr. President, that it's It's truly an honor for Brookings to have you here. Our work at Brookings is to promote a new understanding about Latin America here in Washington with the U.S. Congress, the U.S. administration. And it really helps a lot to have presidents like you that come with clear ideas, with a clear platform, with an approach that is very concrete, very practical, that we know in our region has been lacking in many cases at the political sphere. So it's very refreshing to have you, and to and we are again very thankful for you to have chosen Brookings as the outlet for your first presentation here in the U.S. Let me begin with a comment on the economic issues. By reading your platform and your basically the main campaign proposals, you put a lot of emphasis on employment generation, and particularly the figure of 2 million new jobs for Chile was something that was widely publicized.
Don't expand our goals from 1 million to 2 million.
Okay, 1 million.
1 million is enough.
1 million, yes. You're right. So the earthquake can be seen by the pessimists as a challenge that will compromise that goal, by the optimists as something that can actually help reinvigorate the economy by generating new activity, especially in infrastructure, in construction. But the pessimists highlight the fact that for the reconstruction, there will be the need to raise taxes at a time when the world economy is not growing, at the time when the Chilean peso is appreciating, so that could compromise competitiveness. What do you say to the critics? How do you see these two objectives, the 1 million jobs and the reconstruction and the needs of new government funds, reconcile?
Well, on March the 11th, when the inauguration ceremony was supposed to take place, I was waiting at 12:35 to enter our Congress. And at that, between 12:35 and between 11:35 and 12 a.m., we had three earthquakes. Two of them were major ones. At that time, there was a tsunami alert, and the city of Valparaiso was ordered to be evacuated. So I was with my wife and waiting to enter, and somebody asked me whether I wanted to save my life or to become president. And I decided to become president. And I entered that Congress where people were really scared to death. There were many, many presidents of Latin America. So let me tell you something. Of course, the earthquake is something that if we could have avoided, we would have done it, because it was a major hit to our country. The total cost is $30 billion in terms of school destroyed, houses destroyed, hospital destroyed, infrastructure, and the blow to the public, to the private sector. I think that we will recover between $5 and $8 billion from insurance compensation. Therefore, the net cost will be something between $22 and $25 billion. And in gross terms, 50% of that will have to be faced by the public sector and the other half by the private sector. Therefore, we are planning to face a new challenge which will cost us $10 billion within the next 4 years. That, of course, that's a blessing and an opportunity. It's a blessing from one point of view, and it's a tragedy from another point of view. How we will fund that? We are fully aware that if we just use our foreign savings, okay, we will be depreciating our exchange rate, and that won't be good for our economy. If we just rely on domestic debt, we will be pushing our interest rate to high. That's why we have put a plan that will distribute the burden in six different sources. Austerity, we have already cut public expenditure significantly in areas that were not the most important one. The second one, as I told you before, is the use of our foreign savings. The third one is public debt. The fourth one is taxes. The fifth one is donation that we will try to get from the private sector. That's why we're passing a law, or we're sending today a law to Congress. And the last one was to sell non-core assets of the public sector. Therefore, we are trying not to affect in a significant way the exchange rate and the interest rate. And therefore, I think it's a very balanced plan. Now, in terms of taxes, you know, everybody wants to be taxed except when you're taxing them. That's something that is part of the human nature. We will announce our package in full details within this week. But we think that the growth rate of Chile, that for this year we were expecting a 5.5 rate of growth, will be affected. And therefore, we have changed our plans from 5.5% this year to 4.5%. But we are keeping our goals for 2011, 12, and 13. And therefore, we think that we will be able to achieve an average growth rate very close to 6%, which was our goal before the earthquake. On the other hand, we will need a lot of unity in order to be able to successfully face this earthquake. And that's why we are trying to create a consensus within the country on how to face this tragedy. And we hope that the opposition will be a constructive one. And we have here a very distinguished representative, two very distinguished representatives, Senator Walker and Senator Allende. And I see from their eyes that they are agreeing with me. Thank you very much, Senators.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. President. You know, by listening to your answer, one of the issues, when you observe Chile and you read about Chile, Chile is, by the way, for all of those of you that are not totally aware, is the model for many Latin American countries in terms of the reform agenda and how to do things. And we're always in great debt to Chile because of those roads and those new areas of reform. But one area in which Chile has not been at the same level of speed as, say, countries like Brazil or even Colombia is in allowing the private sector to take a share of the key strategic assets of the state. And if you think, for example, in Petrobras, it's already in the hands of the private sector, a good chunk of the shares. Ecopetrol, the same. The discussion of Codelco in Chile is somewhat more difficult. And Codelco, for those of you who are not totally aware, is the state-owned Chilean copper corporation. So, why is that issue so difficult in Chile?
Well, first of all, Codelco is 100% owned by the state, and that's part of our constitution. And therefore, to introduce any change on this, you need a very broad and solid agreement, which has never been achieved. There are many reasons why we have this constitutional restraint. Maybe it's because of history of copper. Remember that copper was nationalized during the President Frei government, and then was nationalized again during President Allende's government. And therefore, it has a very strong emotional aspect. And that's why we have Codelco property in our constitution. So any change on this will need two-thirds of Congress. That's why we're not, in our program, we are not innovating in this area. But we can innovate in other areas. For instance, Codelco owns Edelnor, which is an electric plant, which is not part of its core business. And we are studying what to do with non-core public assets as part of our package to fund our rebuilding program. But any time that you touch Codelco in Chile, you will get into a very, very intensive and ideological discussion. And we don't want to spend the next week, month in this kind of discussion, because we want to concentrate on the rebuilding effort on one area and on in our government program on the other. But we are intending to include in our plan the disposal of selling at market price in a transparent way of many, many non-core public assets. but we are not including Codelco in our package. And I would like that to be very clear, because otherwise that will be the main news tomorrow in our papers.
Thank you. Well, thank you for answering the question. And it's very clear, the answer. Moving a little bit into the politics and the political issues, you'll be sitting tomorrow at lunch next to President Obama. That's a special deference that the White House has made to you, because there are 40 other heads of state here in Washington. I'm sure President Obama would like to know from you how things are going in Chile, especially in terms of the reconstruction and your first weeks in office. But I don't think there are big, big issues in the bilateral agenda. Maybe you can correct me on that. So I would expect President Obama to move on the conversation with you to more general issues on Latin America, your perceptions about Latin America, issues like Honduras, which have created somewhat of a division in the region. So I don't know if you could share with us what would you tell President Obama if he asks you on your general perception about the current situation in Latin America?
Well, I see Latin America like two models. And each country, of course, has the right to choose its path. On the one hand, you have the model that is being followed by countries like Venezuela, Cuba, Nicaragua, maybe Bolivia, eventually Ecuador. And that's what they have chosen. On the other hand, is another model, which is based on free, open economies, is based in traditional democratic values, state of law, independence of the different public powers, freedom of press, and so on, the model that you have lived in this country since your independence. In that second group, you could include countries like Mexico, Colombia, Peru, Chile. I'm absolutely convinced that the second model is the best path for Chile, and therefore I'm planning to follow that model, which means to improve the quality of democracy, and we have a lot of ideas on that area, including the right, expanding the right of vote to Chileans living abroad, and improving the quality of political parties, and many other aspects. In terms of in the economic area, we will follow what has been the path of Chile for many, many decades, to strengthen our market economy, an open, competitive, and transparent market economy. But we will add something which is very, very important, which has been in the agenda since ever in our country, but we have never been able to really achieve important goals, which is to reduce the level of inequality in Chile, which is extremely high. We have the same level of inequality today that we had when the democratic system was restored in Chile, and we are planning to do very important progress in that area, which will be part of our fight to defeat poverty. And therefore, I think that there are two different models, and that's something that we'll have to learn to live with, because at the end of the day, we have to be able to live in Latin America respecting our different views. With respect to Honduras, of course that we condemned the coup d'etat that took place in Honduras, and it was a coup d'etat. And we are very, very committed to defend democracy. That's why we have been talking with José Miguel Insulza, General Secretary of the OAS, in a project to improve the Carta Interamericana, la Carta Interamericana Democrática, the Inter-American Democratic Charter. Because today we have good tools to defend our democracy when the enemy is beyond the system, when the coup comes from abroad, from beyond the system. But we don't have a good system to protect democracy when the challenges come from within the system. And therefore, we would like to change the Inter-American Democratic Chart in order to strengthen the power of the General Secretary of the OAS, and maybe incorporate an idea that every year the General Secretary has to give a report of the state of democracy in each and every country of Latin America or member of the OAS. And at the same time, when you have problems in the democratic system from within. For instance, a president that maybe that might have been elected democratically, but in the exercise of its power become anti-democratic. And there is nothing that can be done today with, given the Inter-American Democratic Chart. I would like that the General Secretary of the OAS has the same power even to suspend the membership of that country, as it has today when the problems come from beyond the system. That I think that the OAS should have the same power to take action when the problems against democracy come from within the system. That's something that will have to take place. Now, in the case of Honduras, we have been following very closely what President Lobo has been doing, how he's accomplished the agreements that were achieved in San Jose and Tegucigalpa, and I hope that Honduras will be able to become part of the OAS and to restore its full and plain democracy as soon as possible. And if we can help on that, we will do it. I know that the U.S. has already recognized Honduras, but most Latin American countries haven't. And that's something that we will have to discuss with President Obama. I hope that we'll be able to discuss with President Obama, not only with President Obama, also with President Lula, President Fernandez, and President Calderon that will be in this nuclear summit.
Speaking about President Cristina Fernandez and President Lula, you were just last week, I think Thursday and Friday, visiting Argentina and Brazil, which is customary for newly inaugurated Chilean presidents to go and visit. Was this topic part of the conversation in your meetings in Buenos Aires and Brasilia?
Yes. We discussed the Honduras issue with President Fernandez and President Lula. And basically, all of us want the same. We would like Honduras to be part of the OAS again and to become part of the democratic family in Latin America as soon as possible. But of course, we are following what Honduras has been doing. They have accomplished many of the agreements that were achieved in San Jose, but not all of them. And therefore, we hope that Honduras will continue to take steps towards restoring its full democracy. And at that time, I hope that every Latin American country will be able to recognize the new government and reincorporate Honduras to the Latin American and democratic community.
Well, thank you very much. I think it's now time for opening the floor for your questions. I'm going to ask you to please be very brief in your questions, and please introduce yourselves as you ask your question. So I'm going to start with the gentleman here in the front row.
Mr. President, really thank you for your remarks. It opens up. I tell all my clients that when we defeated...
Can you speak up a little bit?
When we defeated those British in Virginia, it took 2 months before the British realized they'd been defeated. But now you know in 20 minutes when things happen in other part of the world will affect you. As I understand your presentation of your government, obviously there's a national government, and I take it there's a constitution which says certain things that government can't do towards people. Like if you have jury trial, if somebody's charged with murder, there has to be some type of trial before you can kill the person, put them in jail. But you never talked about having any states. Now, the other thing which you didn't say quietly, or you almost said, was that with respect to the private industry, it's really not a capitalist society where most things are done by private people and they raise the money. And I'm just thinking that there's an adverse effect, perhaps, if one of the big American companies decided they want to come to your country to do business, if they have to make the deal with the government rather than with another group of private people, they may have problems.
All right, thank you. Do you want to take one by one, or should we take a few?
A few.
A few. So let's go. Yes.
Hi. Welcome, Mr. President. Thank you for speaking to us today. My question draws back to the idea of two models in the region. And specifically, I'm interested in your thoughts on your administration's view of taking a more activist approach to the Chilean model, throughout the region. I think we can all agree that the counter model, the Bolivarian model, has been actively pushed throughout the region. And over the next couple of years, do you think we'll see your administration pursue the Chilean model and encouraging others to follow it, or just to maintain it as a model that the other countries can look toward?
We're going to have a question right here.
Yes, Marta Lagos from Latino Barometro. I was just wondering how the earthquake brings an opportunity to reduce the gap between rich and poor, and how you think it's possible to reduce how, what policies, because we know as Chileans that this has been a main goal of all governments, but little and none has been accomplished, and maybe that's the most difficult goal.
Thank you, Marta. Let me take one more for this round, the lady right there, and then we'll close this round and we'll ask the president to comment.
Kelly Myman with McLarty Associates. I was wondering, Mr. President, if you might be able to elaborate a bit more on your plans for privatization in the non-core asset area. Chile is obviously a very attractive investment venue, and I know a lot of folks in the private sector are interested to hear more on those plans when they're available. Thank you.
Well, in terms of foreign investment, Chile has always been a country that has welcomed foreign investment, and we have a very clear treatment for foreign investment. We have a special treatment for foreign investment because they can choose whether they go with the Chilean tax system or whether they choose a fixed tax system, and therefore we are trying to promote foreign investment in Chile. Chile is a country that has been very friendly with Chilean, with foreign investment, and we will keep doing so. And we need a lot of investment in order to be able to recover our growth capacity and job employment creation capacity. With respect to two models, of course there are two models in Latin America, of course. And when I said that the model that I would like to implement or pursue in Chile is not the same that President Chavez is pursuing in Venezuela, it's something so obvious. But I'm sure that he would agree with me on that. If he was asked whether he would like to follow our program, probably he would say no. And that's his views, and I have my own views, and that's part of liberty and freedom. But my impression is that one system or one model is the right one and the other one is the wrong one. That's my opinion. That's why I'm pursuing the model that has been followed in Chile for many, many decades. And I think that the results will prove this impression, and that the results are already proving this. At the end of the day, I think that to strengthen real democracy with respect to opposition, with freedom of press, and with the separation of different public powers is the only way to preserve democracy at the end. And I think that to promote private enterprise, market economy, innovation, is the best way to achieve development. But I think that we will have to add to this, and I will go to the third question, a very radical policy to reduce inequality and to be able to defeat poverty, because that's the Achilles heel of the Latin American system. How will we achieve this? I don't think that the earthquake will improve our capacity to reduce inequality or poverty, because the earthquake hit poor people in a much deeper way than other people, because for obvious reasons, their homes, their schools were more affected. How we will try to reduce inequality and defeat poverty? We will use two types of instrument. The first one will attack the causes of poverty in Chile. And I think that there are mainly three. First, poor people do not have access to jobs. The unemployment rate of the poor in my country is three times larger than the unemployment rate of the most rich sectors of the country. And therefore, we will create 1 million jobs, and most of them will go to low-income families and women. In Chile, the participation of women in the labor force is extremely low for many reasons. First, because they don't have good opportunity to leave their children safely. Secondly, because they don't have enough abilities and capabilities because they don't have access to education or training. And third, because the whole system has not been able to create enough jobs for people that want to work. Therefore, most of that 1 million jobs will go to low-income people and women. And in both cases, that will be a huge and very strong instrument to defeat poverty and inequality. If we were able, the participation in the labor force of male in Chile is roughly the same as any developed country, 72%. But the participation of women in the labor force is 42%, and in other countries is beyond 65%. If we were able to incorporate women to the labor force, that would be enough to defeat poverty in Chile, because most of those women will come from low-income families. The second instrument is to increase the quality of education. In Chile, our educational system is in very bad shape. The quality has been stagnated for the last 20 years, and it's very unequal. And therefore, to improve the quality of education, because in terms of cobertura, we have already been able to reach most of our population, but the quality is still lagging behind. And I think if we are able to increase the quality of education, and for that we need to do major structural reforms that we will propose to the country, will be a second very strong instrument to defeat poverty and to reduce inequality. And the third one is to strengthen families, because it's already been proven that a strong family is a very powerful instrument to reduce inequality and poverty. Those are policies that will attack the causes of poverty and inequality, and will take place, and will take time. But in the meantime, we cannot wait for that, and therefore we are planning to introduce what we have called the ethical familiar income, which is a kind of negative income tax in order to be able to subsidize poor families. In Chile, we have more than 2 million people living in poverty, which represent roughly 13% of the population. But the poverty gap in Chile, the percentage of our national income that would have to be transferred to those 2 million people in order to allow them to achieve the poverty line, is less than 1% of GNP. And therefore, we think that we can do that effort before these other policies that will attack the causes take place and produce results. And we are planning to do so. That's why we, during our campaign, we proposed this ethical familiar income that will be guaranteed to all Chilean families. And of course, we don't want to incentivize bad behaviors, and therefore this negative income tax or guarantee familiar income will be associated with some request that children will have to go to school, that people will have to be either in training process or working, and so on. But I think that this is a major change in our country, because up to now there has been a lot of good intentions, but very bad results in terms of inequality. We are stagnating. In terms of poverty, we were able to do huge progress at the beginning, but our capacity to reduce poverty has been weakening in the last years, and we want to restore our capacity, because our goal is to be able to defeat extreme poverty within our government, and to be able to defeat poverty and underdevelopment within this decade. With respect to privatization, of course we are planning, and it will be part of our plan, to sell some non-core assets. So I would like to be very specific that we are not incorporating a huge, or the biggest public companies at this stage, like Codelco or Enap, but we are incorporating other public property which are not part of the core business of this company. And we hope that that will be a very important source of income and resources to fund our rebuilding program after the earthquake.
Thank you, Mr. President. Let's do another round. So we'll take a question from the gentleman here, and then you.
My name is Jeremy Strozer. I represent the International Stability Integration Society. And I wanted to ask if you could go over some of the highlights of the disaster preparedness and response that Chile had for the earthquake, and then also discuss any changes that you'll be making to those systems to improve future outcomes of disasters.
Thank you. The gentleman just behind you.
Mr. President, my name is Quinn Lucy. I'm actually with FEMA, so I've been following recovery closely, but also my wife is Chilena and survived the 1985 earthquake in Santiago, which, of course, had a very large effect in the country. I have two questions. One, housing after disasters has been very difficult for our country. You have 370,000 homes damaged or destroyed. How are you going to handle that? And maybe more importantly, how are you going to transition those people out of that temporary housing into their permanent homes? And my second question is with the private sector. We don't normally work directly with them or lend directly to them after disasters. Is that something you will do differently? How will you work with the private sector to help them rehabilitate the country after your earthquake?
Thank you. Then we're going to go to the first row here. Yes. Can you just hold on 1 second for the microphone?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. President. I'm Paul Sejas. I'm a member of Brookings Foreign Policy Committee. My question is related to the issue on general comments in reference to the charter amendment to the OAS that you proposed for countries that even were had presidents and governments elected democratically. It seems to me that somewhat incongruent that position with the OAS position of admitting countries and inviting countries that had not been members because they were not democratically elected. So how do you reconcile those two issues?
Well, and the final one, Mr. President, if you allow me, the lady right there.
Thanks. Alejandra Rivas, Georgetown University. Presidente, buenos días. You have mentioned a little bit about this, but I wonder if you could address specifically the dynamics of continuity versus change in Chilean foreign policy. What will change, what will remain the same in your administration vis-a-vis the previous ones? Thank you.
Well, with respect to the highlights of the disaster, well, basically, human lives, we lost or were severely damaged 370,000 houses. 200,000 of them have to be rebuilt. We lost 4,000 schools, which represent roughly 50% of the school of the area affected, which represents 75% of the population. So the area affected is almost the whole country. We lost or were severely damaged 79 hospitals. Therefore, the stroke was extremely hard. Now, with respect to how to what are the lessons that we had to take? First of all, our early warning system didn't work. And we will propose to Congress a huge and major restructuring and reform of our early warning system and in order to have a better capability to face new disaster that will come. Chile is a country that has been hit by nature, since its birth. And we have had, as I told you before, two of the worst 5 earthquakes in the world have taken place in Chile. We will propose a major reform of our early warning system, and that's something that we will be able to discuss with the American warning system. And we are talking and working with many other countries in order to take advantage of their experience. With respect to and one of the things that you have to be fully aware that when you have an earthquake of the nature that we had in Chile and so close to the border, to the sea border, the tsunami is something that will come almost for sure. And therefore, you have to have a much better system to evacuate people from the areas in danger, which we didn't have. And the second thing is that public safety has to be protected from the very beginning, and you cannot lose 1 second. And that's another mistake that we made in Chile, that we lost a couple of days, and we had a lot of riots, vandalism, which only aggravated the consequence of earthquake. With respect to housing, Well, we have 370,000 houses that were damaged. We think that 200,000 will have to be rebuilt. Most of them are middle class or low income class people. And therefore, we have already announced a plan by which the government will subsidize the rebuilding of those 200,000 houses. For that, we will use our traditional capabilities, but we will have to create new capabilities to build houses. And here we are making a clear distinction between the emergency and the permanent solution. The emergency, we have already committed roughly 75,000 emergency shelters that will have to be in place before June the 21st, which is the beginning of our winter. We have already done one-third of that goal, and it's a huge challenge to be able to build these 75,000 emergency houses, because that was an industry that we didn't have in Chile. But on the same time, we are already working on the permanent solution, which will impose us the burden of rebuilding 200,000 houses, I hope that within the next 2 years. That means normally Chile is able to build 100,000 houses per year, and we will continue with our normal programs. But we will double that goal because of the earthquake, and that will put a tremendous pressure on our private sector. And that's why I think that the new industry is emerging in my country, which is the industry of prefabricated wood houses, which was something that didn't exist. It was a very small industry. And we think that we have huge comparative advantage because we have the wood, we have the people, we have everything. And therefore, that industry has already emerged and is developing very rapidly. And I hope that after the earthquake, we'll have a new export industry, which will be prefabricated homes for other countries. And the two challenges are extremely tough. To be able to build 75,000 emergency houses before June the 21st is a very difficult task. And to be able to double the capacity of our economy to build permanent houses is also a very difficult challenge. But I think, I'm really convinced that according to what has already been achieved, that we will be able to achieve those two goals. With respect to the OAS, it's true. Probably you are referring to Cuba. In the case of Cuba, what I understand, and Jose Miguel is here, that Cuba will be able to become part of the OAS when they fulfill all the requirements of the OAS. So I don't see any contradiction, because what has been approved is that Cuba can come back to the OAS whenever they ask for it, but when they fulfill all the commitments that the OAS has imposed to them, to all the countries that are members of the OAS. So I don't see any country that will join the OAS without restoring its democratic system. That's a precondition to become part of the OAS. Otherwise, we will be in contradiction with the Inter-American Democratic Charter. But I hope that Cuba will someday be part of the OAS again. And on this, there are many opinions. I'm not sure whether the economic embargo has been a good idea or a bad idea. At the end of the day, what we want, the U.S. wants, and all Latin America wants, is that Cuba will be able to restore its democratic system, to really fulfill and protect human rights and individual liberties, and to become part of the OAS again. We would like Cuba to be part of the OAS, and Chile would like Cuba to become part of the OAS again. And for that, of course, it's necessary that Cuba fulfill all the democratic, human rights, and individual liberties conditions that are part of the Inter-American Democratic Charter. So I don't see any incoherence on this area. Maybe Jose Miguel.
No, no.
Good.
And then there is the student from Georgetown on this issue of continuity versus change in foreign policy.
Well, in Chile, foreign policy has always been a state policy based on principles. Respect of international law, respect of international treaties, respect of non-intervention on other countries' issue, protection of democracy, human rights, and individual liberties. Those in all those areas, there will be a continuity. Of course, we will strengthen our relationship with our neighbor countries, and we hope that we will be able to face our relationship with Argentina, Peru, and Bolivia in a more dynamic way, in a more innovative way. But I would say that in foreign relations, there will be no major changes because that's something that has always been a state policy in my country.
Thank you, Mr. President. I think we only have time for a couple more questions. So let's start with Cindy right there.
Thank you. Cindy Arnson from the Woodrow Wilson Center. Thank you for this opportunity. The government of Chile is one of a handful of Latin American governments that is participating in the nuclear summit. I was wondering if you could comment on relationship between Brazil and Iran and what, if any, position the Chilean government has taken with respect to non-proliferation and the sanctions against the Iranian government in this respect.
Thank you very much. Was there anyone else behind? So let me ask.
Thank you, Mr. President. I work at a hedge fund called Eden Park, and I was curious the extent to which you see regulation or any of the frameworks in the renewable energy space changing as a result of the earthquake or being expanded in any way. And as a separate question, to what extent do you worry about the supply side shock and what it may mean for the inflation trajectory going forward?
Let me take one final, right, the gentleman in the back.
Hi, my name is Benjamin Gadan. I'm a student at Johns Hopkins SAIS. I wonder, you come to the presidency after a career in the private sector. I haven't heard you speak a lot about the diversification of the Chilean economy, the addressing the over-reliance on copper and the same commodity reliance that has left a lot of Latin American economies very vulnerable to price fluctuations.
So why don't you deal with these three questions?
Well, with respect to the nuclear issue, I'm convinced that the main threats in this area do not come from traditional countries that have nuclear weapons, but basically will come from an excessive proliferation of nuclear weapons to too many countries or to terrorist groups and things like that. And that's the main objective of the Security Nuclear Summit that we will attend today and tomorrow. And I think that it's absolutely necessary for the world to take action in this area, because if we do not act, probably that proliferation will continue. And the more it continues, the biggest the danger is that someday, not the traditional country, but other groups, like terrorist group or anarchist group, will be able to achieve nuclear capabilities and use those weapons of mass destruction for their purposes. And therefore, I think that it's extremely important that we take action on this. I see that the START agreement to reduce or at least contain the amount of nuclear weapons in the world is a very good step that has been taken between Russia and the U.S. I think that Latin America is the only continent in the world, after the Tlatelolco agreement, there's a nuclear-free area. And I think that that's an excellent example for the rest of the world. I dream that someday we will have a world nuclear-free environment. But in the meantime, we have to be extremely conscious and take actions, because the proliferation of nuclear weapons is the main threat that we are facing now, and that's the main target of this summit. With respect to Brazil, by the way, Chile is contributing to this. A few days ago, we sent to the U.S. our highly enriched uranium, because when you have highly enriched uranium that is a subproduct of our two nuclear reactions which are that we have in Chile that are for investigation purposes, that highly enriched uranium is the previous step to nuclear weapons, and therefore it's very important that uranium will be absolutely safe And that's why we are collaborating with the system by sending our highly enriched uranium to the U.S., which took place a couple of weeks ago. And according to all the local and international rules. With respect to Brazil and Iran, of course I'm concerned with Iran achieving nuclear capability, like most people. And I think that it's very important that the world and the international system is able to achieve an agreement to stop that process. And therefore, what Brazil, I know that the president of Iran visited Brazil, but it doesn't mean that Brazil is supporting that effort. And therefore, we have to make a distinction. One thing is to have an open dialogue. Another thing is to support this initiative. I do not support that initiative. I would like, of course, to really contribute to the non-proliferation effort that is taking place in the world. With respect to energy after the earthquake, of course we will not rebuild buildings as they were before and houses as they were before. We will take advantage of new technologies, particularly new, more energy efficient and more and new and environmental technology to build our houses and our buildings in a different way. That's why we visited yesterday in New Orleans. The new houses that are being built there, which they call them greenhouses, because they are much more effective in terms of energy, much more effective in terms of protecting the environment. And that's a lesson that we will apply in Chile, because we're fully aware that we will have to contribute to the effort of reducing gases that will produce all the problems in the environment that are being produced today. And finally, with respect to diversification, of course we are trying to diversify our economy. Actually, we're extremely successful at that because copper represented 80% of our export 20 years ago, and today they were less than one-third. But the price of copper went up, and that's a blessing for my country. But one consequence of that is that copper has recovered a larger participation in our export. But we are promoting, and our government will promote, a diversification of our economy, particularly in small and medium-sized companies. For those companies, we have a huge program to incentivize innovation, entrepreneurship, and their integration to the international economy. So diversification is something very important. But in our case, since we are and we will keep being a country very dependent on copper prices, we have set a system. When the copper price is above the normal limits, we save the proceeds of that boom in the copper price. And when it comes below the normal path, we are able to spend. That's why we have this copper fund that is what we call the Fondo Económico Social, FES. And therefore, we are introducing our own system to be able not to be so dependent on copper prices. But of course, the most powerful system is to diversify our economy, and we are working on that. And we, one of our goals is to be able to create new industries, new exports industry in our country. One of them will be due to the earthquake, which is the prefabricated or industrialized wood housing industry. And therefore, diversification is something that we are looking forward, and we are working on that. But finally, I think to summarize that before the earthquake, we did have an extremely challenging program with very, very challenging goals, growth, jobs, crime, education, health. Now we have had another goal, which is to face the emergency. And as I told you before, the emergency of the earthquake has been divided in three phases, not chronological, because many of them are simultaneous. The first one was the immediate emergency, which was to restore public order, to take care of the people that lost their lives, to rescue the victims, to search for the people that were disappeared, to restore the availability of electricity and water. That has already been done. up to a level of 98%. We still have some small problems in those areas. The second phase is the winter emergency, which is basically to build these emergency houses, to restore the normality of the educational system, and to be able to provide health services to everybody, given that we have so many hospitals that are not being utilized because of the destruction that they suffered. But the most important one is the rebuilding of what the earthquake destroyed in terms of bridges, roads, schools, housing, hospitals, and also the rebuilding of the production capability of the private sector that was also hit. That's why we are proposing within this week to Congress a package that will be roughly an 8 to 10 billion extraordinary package to be able to rebuild the public sector. And that package will be funded or financed, using those six sources that I mentioned before. All of them will be part of our package, and I hope that that package will be approved promptly in Congress, because it's time to work on the rebuilding. And we have established a four-year period for completing the rebuilding process in Chile. And for that, we will need a lot of unity. And when I started my administration, I started by calling to behave within the new unity spirit within my country. And that was necessary before the earthquake, because the goals were so challenging: to defeat poverty, to defeat underdeveloped. Now that we have to face also the consequence of the earthquake, this unity, which doesn't mean that we are confusing what is the role of government and what is the real role of the opposition. Of course, everybody has to play its own role. But within a national goal, which is now three things: to defeat poverty and underdevelopment within these decades, and to be able to face the consequence of the earthquake within the next 4 years. That's the goal of my government, and I hope that we will be successful. And I hope also that we will have a rigorous but constructive opposition. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. President. You have been very gracious in answering every single question with no restrictions, and that's really unique. That's something we really acknowledge. And let me just say, in concluding, that we wish you all the luck, not just in these reconstruction efforts, but also in making sure that your long-term agenda, which is bringing the Chilean economy back on track, but especially in reducing and closing the gap in inequality and eradicating extreme poverty, are achieved, not just for the benefit of the Chilean population, but because many eyes are placed on Chile. As you very well explained, there are two models, and the Chilean model is an example. So the ability of your government to solve these problems, it's going to be very influential for other countries that want to follow the same route. So thank you very much, and it's been an honor and a privilege to have you here at Brookings in your first U.S. engagement.
Thank you.